You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warrenton.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
What is patriotism? Is it love of one's birthplace, the place of childhood's recollections and hopes, dreams and aspirations? Leo Tolstoy, the greatest anti-patriot of our times, defines patriotism as the principle that will justify the training of wholesale murderers. A trade that requires better equipment for the exercise of man-killing than the making of such necessities of life as shoes, clothing, and houses. A trade that guarantees better returns and greater glory than that of the average working man. Indeed, conceit, arrogance, and egotism are the essentials of patriotism. Let me illustrate. Patriotism assumes that our globe is divided into little spots, each one surrounded by an iron gate. Those who have had the fortune of being born on some particular spot consider themselves better, nobler, grander, more intelligent than the living beings inhabiting any other spot. It is therefore the duty of everyone living on that chosen spot to fight, kill, and die in the attempt to impose his superiority upon all the others. The inhabitants of the other spots reason in like manner, of course, with the result that, from early infancy, the mind of the child is poisoned with blood-curdling stories about the Germans, the French, the Italians, Russians, etc. When the child has reached manhood, he is thoroughly saturated with the belief that he is chosen by the Lord himself to defend his country against the attack or invasion of any foreigner. It is for that purpose that we are clamoring for a greater army and navy, more battleships and ammunition. We Americans claim to be peace-loving people. We hate bloodshed. We are opposed to violence. Yet we go into spasms of joy over the possibility of projecting dynamite bombs from flying machines upon helpless citizens. We are ready to hang, electrocute, or lynch anyone who, from economic necessity, will risk his own life in the attempt upon that of some industrial magnate. Yet our hearts swell with pride at the thought of America becoming the most powerful nation on earth, and that it will eventually plant her iron foot on the necks of all other nations. Such is the logic of patriotism. Thinking men and women the world over are beginning to realize that patriotism is too narrow and limited a conception to meet the necessities of our time. The centralization of power has brought into being an international feeling of solidarity among the oppressed nations of the world, a solidarity which represents a greater harmony of interests between the working man of America and his brothers abroad than between the American miner and his exploiting compatriot, a solidarity which fears not for an invasion because it is bringing all the workers to the point when they will say to their masters, Go and do your own killing. We have done it long enough for you. This solidarity is awakening the consciousness of even the soldiers, they too being flesh of the great human family. A solidarity that has proven infallible more than once during past struggles, and which has been the impetus inducing the Parisian soldiers during the Commune of 1871 to refuse to obey when ordered to shoot their brothers. It has given courage to men who mutinied on Russian warships during recent years. It will eventually bring about the uprising of all the oppressed and downtrodden against their international exploiters. When we have undermined the patriotic lie, we shall have cleared the path for that great structure wherein all nationalities shall be united into a universal brotherhood, a truly free society.
Those are the words of Emma Goldman, spoken in 1908, as recreated by Lily Taylor, to set the tone for the program this week and the conclusion of the three-part documentary, The Trap, What Happened to Our Dream of Freedom by Adam Curtis, and the final chapter in our ongoing reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. I've enjoyed running the Curtis documentary and the Gatto reading in tandem for you because both illuminate how various ideologies purporting to create freedom have instead created different forms of oppression. In Curtis' documentary, we've heard and will hear the voices of various political actors who have perpetrated atrocity in the name of freedom. It could be that the speakers themselves know their words are empty rhetoric, a mask behind which to hide their real purpose, the indulgence of their greed and lust for power. But what makes Curtis' documentary interesting to me is that he takes the express goals of figures like Tony Blair and Ronald Reagan at face value, and thus sheds light on a different question, not whether these are liars or bad people, you can be the judge of that, but rather that all the actions of power turn the leaders into tyrants and the people into robots. Curtis suggests and Gatto declares that the project goes wrong because of its fundamental structure, the imposition of a way of life or a way of thought from the top upon the population, and that this approach is predicated upon a view of people as a statistical group which self-styled leaders must manage. Curtis' documentary shows that it is the managing of people that obviates freedom, rather than the specific ideologies of the managers. Remove the managers and the mindset of management, and people will naturally step towards freedom and the responsibility that accompanies that power. Before we begin messing with the minds of children, they know how to be free. They do not choose leaders. They insist upon their fair share. They follow a friend who has a good idea and refuse to play with those who bully. It's not until they're put into school that they learn submission to rank and grade, unless, of course, they come from the authoritarian homes of parents who've internalized the culture of management and control. Though Curtis and Gatto come from different political perspectives and focus on different parts of the picture of society and freedom, both make clear that freedom must be for something as well as relief from something, and that it cannot be imposed, and that the leaders who claim to be champions of freedom will do anything but abjure their power over the lives of others. It's hardly surprising, then, that things turn out so badly. What surprises me is why we continue to tolerate it. Perhaps because the word freedom is so difficult to understand. The problem is, perhaps, that it is not really some abstract concept of freedom that we want, that what we really want is to live in a society based on love, of ourselves, of others, of the place we call home. Were we to achieve that, I think the issue of freedom would take care of itself. Some would say that's even more of a pipe dream than achieving freedom, but I don't think so. Freedom is an abstract concept that has arisen in opposition to the brutality of social hierarchies. Love, however, is an ancient part of our nature as well as the nature of other animals. Whether it is, as some might say, a strategy of genes to reproduce themselves, or a metaphysical essence, as others would say, really does not matter. It is what it is. It is part of what we are. We can't help but feel it. The question, then, is what sort of society would nurture that? Fear, too, is a part of our nature, as old and deep as love. And it seems to me that what modern societies have in common, irrespective of what they call themselves ideologically, is that they are all based on the primacy of fear.
This series of films has told the story of the rise of a narrow and peculiar kind of freedom. The last two programs have shown how politicians from both the right and the left came to believe in a simplistic model of human beings as self-seeking, almost robotic creatures. Out of this came a new and simplified idea of politics. No longer did politicians set out to change the world. Instead, they saw their job as being to deliver nothing more than what these free individuals wanted. And at the same time, we too came to think of ourselves as simplified beings, whose behavior and even feelings could be analyzed objectively by scientific systems which told us what was the normal way to feel. And both we and our leaders have come to believe that this is the true definition of freedom. There is no other. But there is. There is an alternative idea of freedom, but we have hidden and forgotten about it because it can be so frightening and dangerous. It is the dream of not only changing the world, but also transforming people. And by changing them, you can then free them from themselves. This film will go back and unearth that forgotten idea of freedom. It will show why it is so dangerous and why it was hidden. But it will also show why this idea still haunts us. Because it inspires people. It offers hope and meaning in a way that our narrow version of freedom was deliberately designed to exclude. The architects of our present world set us a terrible trap. In seeking to protect us from the dangers of the other kind of freedom, they led us into a world without meaning.
The trap, what happened to our dream of freedom? Part 3, we will force you to be free.
To understand these two ideas of freedom and how they came to oppose each other, you have to go back to the Oxford of the 1950s and to a man who did more than anyone to define them. He was one of the most important liberal thinkers of the 20th century. He was called Isaiah Berlin. Berlin was an extraordinary figure. He was born in St. Petersburg and witnessed the Russian Revolution. His family then fled to Britain. And Berlin grew up to become one of the central figures in the British establishment. During the war, he served as a diplomat in America and got to know many of the young politicians who would later run America during the Cold War. In the 50s, Berlin became a political philosopher at Oxford and a celebrity. He was featured in Vogue and appeared regularly on the BBC. At the heart of Berlin's thought was the question of individual freedom and how to protect it.
But I think what Svenny says is it comes to the same, which is a question of freedom. You want to feel free to make mistakes. I think I objected not being reasoned with. I object to paternalism. I think what I object to is being treated like a schoolboy, being told my own good that there are certain things to do, or being driven in a perfectly beneficent direction by a perfectly disinterested, pure-hearted body of anyone like governments or manufacturers, it doesn't matter which, human beings or children. We must first herd them together, create certain institutions, make them obey orders, and we hope later they will see how well we've done for them, and they will become rational in the course of... this is exactly what the British Empire fell towards. Coloured people in Africa, it's exactly what schoolmasters feel towards children, and it always leads to bad consequences in the end.
And for Berlin, the greatest threat to individual freedom in the world was the Soviet Union. In October 1956, the Hungarian people had risen up and toppled their communist government. In response, Soviet forces invaded and brutally suppressed the rebellion, massacring thousands. The Soviet action shocked the world. And for Berlin, it defined the central paradox of the age. How could the Soviet system, which had been designed and built on the dream of liberating individuals from tyranny, have become such an oppressive and tyrannical force in the world? Berlin believed that he had the answer, and he set out to explain what had happened. And in doing this, he was going to offer what he believed was a better and a safer idea of freedom. In 1958, Berlin gave a lecture at Oxford, which he called Two Concepts of Liberty. It would become one of the key ideological underpinnings of the Cold War. There are, he said, in fact, two very different kinds of freedom. One he called positive liberty, the other negative liberty. And to explain them, Berlin went back into the past. Both ideas originated, he said, in the same impulse more than 200 years before, at the time of the French Revolution, of individuals wanting to free themselves from the oppression of tyrants and despots. Positive liberty, Berlin explained, was born out of the belief of those who led these revolutions that to be truly free, people had to be transformed. They had to become better, rational beings. And only the leaders knew what that ideal human being should be and how it could be created. This, Berlin said, led to a terrible logic in all revolutions. The masses, who did not realize what true freedom was, had to be coerced. At the height of the French Revolution, the Jacobin leader, Robespierre, explained this. Terror for a revolutionary government, he said, is very different from the terror used by tyrants in the past. Because now it meant the destruction of those whose moral corruption was barring the way to a new society of virtue. Terror has become, he said, the despotism of liberty against tyranny. Another of the Jacobins, Saint-Just, put it more simply. We must force the people to be free. From the French terror to the show trials and the mass executions in the Soviet Union, this logic always led, Berlin argued, to horror and the very opposite of freedom. Positive liberty, he said, would always fail because it was driven by a false belief that there was one true answer to all human ills.
Once you believe that, the idea of the final answer to human ills, if it is the final answer, then no sacrifice is too great for it.
Sir Isaiah Berlin.
And even if you have to kill people for it. Mm-hmm. This is the one end, the permanent bliss, happiness of mankind, surely worth it. If you believe there is a single answer to a single question, the true answer, all the other answers being false. Yeah. And, and all these answers can be put together and harmonize with each other and create the perfect universe. Then there is a temptation, if you think you have it, to do awful things.
Against this corrupt ideal, Berlin defined his other idea of freedom, negative liberty. Negative liberty, he said, is the freedom of all individuals to do what they want and nothing more. There should be government and laws to ensure that individuals' actions do not interfere with each other's freedoms. But other than that, power should be restrained. Negative liberty was a society deliberately without ideals, other than individuals' desires and the freedom to indulge them. As the last two programs showed, this was a similar vision to the ideas of the economists and the technocrats of the Cold War. They had put forward an idea of a society comprised only of millions of self-seeking individuals, which, their mathematics said, would lead automatically to stability and order. What Berlin was doing was giving this vision a sense of destiny and historical inevitability. By counterposing negative liberty to positive liberty with its inevitable horrors, Berlin was saying that this kind of society was the only safe alternative for the West in the Cold War. It was the kind of freedom it was fighting for. Berlin's lecture was published, and it became a defining vision for a generation who set out to educate the masses that all attempts at revolution, however seductive and romantic, would always lead to disaster, and that power always had to be restrained.
What is that I hear? That note of urgency, of indignation, of spiritual hunger.
Kenneth Clark, Civilization, BBC TV.
Yes, it's Beethoven. It's the sound of European man once more reaching for something beyond his grasp.
Oh, freedom, freedom, come to us again. This cry has echoed through all the countless revolutionary movements of the last century. They'd suffered from the most terrible of all delusions. They believed themselves to be virtuous, and in the end were destroyed by the evil means they had brought into existence.
And the other half of the message from the Cold War intellectuals was that systems should be created to restrain politicians' power, especially those leaders who said they wanted to do good for us, because inexorably they would become tyrants.
Every tyrant in history has said that he wants power to do good to his fellows.
Malcolm Muggeridge. Yes.
But don't you think that that the necessary thing is to check and stop people having power? I hate government.
Yes.
I hate power.
Yes.
I think that man's existence, insofar as he achieves anything, is to resist power.
Yes.
To minimize power. To devise systems of society in which power is the least exerted.
Yes.
But Isaiah Berlin knew that it was going to be difficult to achieve and maintain this negative idea of freedom. And in his lecture, and throughout his life, he warned of the danger it would face. Those who promote negative liberty must never come to believe it is an absolute ideal. Because such a belief in one final answer always leads to coercion and the opposite of freedom. But this was exactly what was going to happen, and Berlin's warning would become a prophecy. Ironically, this corruption of negative liberty would begin with the resurgence of positive liberty. In the wake of the Soviet disaster, a new and even more extreme version of positive liberty was about to rise up in the Third World. It would be a revolutionary vision of transforming individuals through violence. It would spread and begin to destabilize the balance of power in the world. In response, the followers of negative liberty in the West would decide that they had to confront and roll back this tide. Out of this would emerge a strange mutant idea. You would use violent revolutionary techniques to create a world of negative freedom. In the late 50s, a series of wars of liberation began. People who had been ruled by colonial powers fought to free themselves. One of the first was the Algerian Revolution, led by a Marxist group, the FLN. Out of the struggle emerged a powerful new figure, a black intellectual called Frantz Fanon, who became a leading ideologist of the revolution. Fanon believed that the West exercised its control by getting inside people's minds, turning them into passive zombies. The only way for individuals to free themselves from this, he said, was through violence, including terrorism. Violence was not just a battle against the military. The very experience of the armed struggle would, Fanon said, be cathartic. It would awaken the revolutionaries from the West's insidious form of control and turn them into what he called new men. A famous film called The Battle of Algiers was made, which dramatised Fanon's ideas.
Stuart Hall, cultural historian.
This is the bit that interests Fanon, the seizure of liberty by the oppressed people. And he thought that there was something liberating about that very act of armed seizure, of defeating the enemy, and the self-respect which would arise from an autonomous struggle of that kind. Constructing the new man entirely, the freed, out of this struggle. As if, you know, the traumas of the past, of previous relations, could be wished away. As if the Revolutionary War would be a sort of blanking out of everything, and a complete tabula rasa, start again from the beginning.
Behind Fanon's ideas was a very specific Western idea of freedom, the existential ideas of the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Fanon had been educated in Paris in the 1950s and had become a friend of Sartre's. And he had been deeply influenced by Sartre's idea that individuals are trapped in a narrow and bleak idea of freedom by the pressures of the society around them. To achieve true freedom, Sartre said, one had to find ways to break through this illusion. And what Fanon did was turn this idea into a revolutionary theory. And his ideas became the guiding force behind nearly all the Third World revolutions of the 60s and the 70s. They inspired Che Guevara, Yasser Arafat, and Steve Biko in South Africa. And Fanon's ideas also inspired Sartre himself. Sartre believed that they could be applied not just in the Third World, but in the West itself. He became convinced that it was only through revolutionary violence that individuals in the West could truly free themselves from the controls of bourgeois society.
Jean-Paul Sartre has translated.
You have to understand that all revolutionaries understand today that there is no way of overthrowing modern society except by violence, for the very good reason that this society defends itself by repression and violence. I'm defending a revolutionary cause because my personal goal, which is that of all those here, is to overthrow bourgeois society.
Out of ideas like these came waves of terrorist attacks in Europe in the early 70s. Those who led the attacks believed that the terror was a way of breaking through the bourgeois facade to a new freedom. Then, in 1975, the logic of this idea reached its most extreme incarnation when the Khmer Rouge revolutionaries liberated Cambodia. Their leader, Pol Pot, had also studied revolutionary theories in Paris. And he believed that the only way for Cambodian society to reach utopia was to destroy the whole of bourgeois society and start again, back to year zero. Within hours of arriving in the capital, Phnom Penh, the Khmer Rouge set about slaughtering all the middle classes, some 3 million people in the end, because under Pol Pot's logic, they stood in the way of allowing the rest of the people to become truly free individuals.
Jim Howard, field director, Oxfam.
Pol Pot also appealed to many Cambodians living in France, intellectuals, professionals, doctors, teachers, to come back to Cambodia in 1975, 1976, to help with the new regime to build a new society. And many of them, when they came back, were actually slaughtered, murdered actually on the airport when they arrived in the planes. Just this was a sort of wanton destruction of any opposition, of any sort of intellectual differences, that the society that Pol Pot was going to build would have no opposition inside or outside of Cambodia.
The chaos caused by these revolutions also began to destabilize the balance of power in the world. And this would inexorably bring them face to face with America and its global battle against communism. But what this clash was going to lead to was the rise in America of a new militant idea of freedom and the belief that it was the United States' duty to spread this freedom around the world by force if necessary. Ever since the Second World War, American governments had struggled to contain the spread of communism. And the wave of Third World revolutions was a dangerous new phase in this battle. To try and stop it, during the 1960s and 70s, American governments adopted a ruthless strategy, backing dictators and tyrants around the world who offered to contain these revolutionary forces. They did this by repressing or killing thousands of their own people. The main architect of this policy was Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State under President Nixon. He used America's power to back dictators like General Pinochet in Chile and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. Kissinger knew that these dictators used torture and mass killing to stay in power. But in his theory of what he called realpolitik, this was the price that had to be paid if Soviet tyranny was to be kept in check. But during the 70s, a group of young radicals emerged in Washington who believed that this was wrong. For America to support torture and killing was a corruption of its ideals. They became known as the neoconservatives, and what linked them was the vision of a new moral kind of foreign policy. America should actively use its great power to spread democracy in the world. One of this group was Michael Ledeen. He called himself a democratic revolutionary.
We were aiming for an expansion of the zone of freedom in the world. And in part that had to do with fighting communism, and in part it had to do with fighting other kinds of tyrannies. But that's what we were about. It's what we're still about. We want, down with tyranny. We want free countries. We think that America's better off if we live in a world primarily populated with free countries who have to appeal to their own people for the source of their power and to ratify their decisions. And we think that if the whole world were like that, then we would be much more secure. We're democratic revolutionaries. We wanted to spread freedom everywhere we could. And it wasn't just communist dictators that we hated. We hated them all.
And then, in 1979, the Iranian Revolution showed dramatically that America's policy of backing dictators did not work. The Iranian people rose up and toppled the Shah of Iran. The Shah had one of the largest military forces in the world, given to him by the Americans. But it proved helpless in the face of the new Islamist ideology of Ayatollah Khomeini. Many in the West saw Khomeini as the resurgence of a dark, almost medieval force. But this was wrong. The Iranian Revolution was yet again driven by Western ideas of political freedom. Behind it lay the ideas of a young Iranian teacher called Ali Shariati. Shariati is an extraordinary historical figure because he single-handedly fused the ideas of Jean-Paul Sartre and Frantz Fanon with Shia Islam to produce a completely new revolutionary ideology. And it was this ideology that lay behind Ayatollah Khomeini's radical vision of political Islam. Like so many revolutionaries, Shariati had studied in Paris in the early 60s. And he had become fascinated by Sartre's ideas of true freedom and Fanon's theories of how to use armed struggle to achieve it. Shariati translated both Fanon and Sartre into Farsi. What he added to their theories was the idea that Shia Islam could be used to give meaning and purpose to the armed struggle and the utopia it would achieve. This was a radically new interpretation. Since the 7th century, Shia Islam had been an apolitical and passive force. Its leaders, the Ayatollahs, told the people that they must not involve themselves in political struggle. They should wait patiently and endure all hardships until the coming of the true Imam. But Shariati had turned Shia Islam into a revolutionary political force that yet again offered to liberate people and transform them in the here and now. It was these ideas that Ayatollah Khomeini had taken up and used to overwhelm America's ally. And in the slogans shouted on the streets in Tehran, what you hear are the Western ideas of positive liberty and the theories of Frantz Fanon.
Mr. Reagan is for freedom, and he is for the people.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States of America, Ronald Reagan!
In 1980, Ronald Reagan ran for president. His campaign message was simple. He promised freedom at home and abroad. When he was elected, many of the young neoconservatives joined his administration, and their ideas became central to the new foreign policy. In October 1981, the new Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, announced to a startled Senate a new moral crusade by America to extend freedom in the world by force, if necessary.
There are things that we Americans must be willing to fight for. This republic was spawned by armed conflict. The freedoms and liberties that we enjoy today were a consequence of armed conflict, insurrection, if you will. There are things worth fighting for. We must understand that. We must structure our policy under that credible and justified premise.
President Reagan signed a series of directives that set up what was called Project Democracy. It had two parts. One set up a series of organizations whose job was to openly promote the idea of democracy abroad. This set out to support groups like Solidarity in Poland, but it also helped overthrow the dictators who had been America's allies. The Reagan administration forced both Ferdinand Marcos and General Pinochet to call elections, which led to their downfall.
Revolution in the Philippines as the Americans abandon Marcos.
And now the White House wants to get rid of the man who for so long has been their ally.
And at the same time, the Americans set up what they called schools for democracy to train the new politicians in these countries. But the democracy that the Americans wanted to create was deliberately simplified. One of the ideologists who inspired Project Democracy, Samuel Huntington, who would later become famous for coining the phrase the clash of civilizations, made this clear. It was a modest form of democracy, he said, where the people are allowed to vote, but nothing else has changed. The wider ideas of democracy, of redistributing land and wealth and creating equality, must not be tried, because that can only be done through coercion. And following the logic of Isaiah Berlin, that would inevitably lead to tyranny. And this is exactly what did happen. Democracy came to the Philippines, but real power simply shifted to a new set of elites, and the vast inequalities and the corruption remained unchanged. It was a modest kind of freedom. The other part of Project Democracy was to use military force in secret operations to overthrow foreign regimes that stood in the way of freedom. The main target was the government of Nicaragua, the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas were Marxist revolutionaries who had seized power in 1979. But since then, they had held elections and had been democratically elected. The Reagan administration dismissed this, though, as a sham. And an operation was set up to enforce the right kind of democracy by overthrowing the Sandinistas if necessary. The man in charge was a leading neoconservative, Elliot Abrams.
What we seek is democracy in Nicaragua, a Nicaragua at peace with its inhabitants and with its neighbors. That might not require a change in the government. What it requires is a change in the policy of that government at the very least.
You want them to surrender to the United States definition?
We want them to stop subverting their neighbors and repressing the people of Nicaragua. Now, does that require the overthrow of the government? Well, it doesn't if they change their behavior. And that's the question. What do you need to do to get them to change their behavior? The answer is pressure.
The Americans started funding and training a counter-revolutionary army called the Contras. But there was enormous political opposition in the United States. And to get round it, the leaders of Project Democracy set out to frighten the American public. An agency called the Office of Public Diplomacy was set up that disseminated what was called white propaganda. It produced dossiers and fed stories to journalists that proved that Soviet fighter planes had arrived in Nicaragua to attack America. Another story, from intelligence sources, said that the Soviets had given stockpiles of chemical weapons to the Sandinistas. President Reagan appeared on television with maps to show how quickly such a chemical attack could be launched on America itself. It was only a matter of time.
The simple questions are, will we support freedom in this hemisphere or not? Will we defend our vital interests in this hemisphere or not? Will we stop the spread of communism in this hemisphere or not? Will we act while there is still time?
Reagan also told America that Nicaragua was part of an axis of rogue states, including Iran and North Korea, who together ran a global network of terror. Those who ran the Office of Public Diplomacy called this technique perception management.
Robert Perry, reporter in Nicaragua, 1980s.
The thinking was that if you could control the perceptions of the American people about events, that would help you bring them on board. If they thought something was a huge threat to them, they perceived it that way, then they would react a certain way. They would react in support of a more aggressive policy. Well, you try to convince that the American people that these folks are out to get you. So we had extreme suggestions that the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, who were a rather pathetic force, having been to Nicaragua and seen them, they would somehow be threatening Texas, or they'd be threatening the Panama Canal.
Today, El Salvador and Guatemala. Tomorrow, the United States.
You can take small threats and make them huge threats. You can make the Sandinistas appear like they're going to conquer the United States.
What was happening was that the neoconservatives were beginning to believe that their ideal of freedom was an absolute, and that this then justified lying and exaggerating in order to enforce that vision, that the end justified the means. Although they portrayed the Contras as freedom fighters, it was well known that they used murder, assassination and torture, and also were allegedly using CIA-supplied planes to smuggle cocaine back into the United States. And to finance the Contras, the neoconservatives were even prepared to deal with America's enemy, the leaders of the Iranian Revolution. In 1985, those running the Nicaragua operation held a series of secret meetings with Iranian leaders in Europe. They arranged to sell the Iranians American weapons. In return, the Iranians would release American hostages held in Lebanon. Then the money from these sales would be used by those running Project Democracy to fund the Contras. The only problem was that this was completely illegal, and the president knew it.
Is that right?
Okay, we're going through channels we can't discuss.
When are you going to come back and see us again?
Not soon.
When are you going to see us?
Let's have another press conference.
Did the vice president object to this plan in Iran, Mr. President? You said that Schultz and Weinberger didn't. Did the vice president?
No.
What was beginning to emerge was the problem with spreading the ideal of freedom around the world. To do it, those leading Project Democracy had turned not just to manipulation and violence, but were beginning to undermine the ideals of democracy in America, the very thing they were trying to create abroad. It was the corruption of freedom that Isaiah Berlin had warned of. But all these problems were about to be put aside, because the West's idea of freedom was about to triumph in the Cold War. In 1989, across Eastern Europe, the people rose up to overthrow their communist leaders. It was a remarkable series of revolutions, all driven by the desire for freedom and the ending of tyranny. The momentum of these revolutions was unstoppable, until in December 1991, the Soviet Union was finally dissolved, and Boris Yeltsin became president of Russia. For many in the West, above all America, this was the triumph of liberal democracy and its ideals. This belief was summed up in the epic argument put forward by the political philosopher Francis Fukuyama, that the world had arrived at the end of history. All competing ideologies, he said, were now dead, and liberal democracy would spread unchallenged around the world.
What you've seen happening in this century, when we began it, there were many competitors to liberal democracy, you know, leftover hereditary monarchies, fascist dictatorships, communist totalitarianism. And virtually all of those major competitors have now disappeared by the end of the 20th century. So that, in a way, it indicates that liberal democracy is now, you know, spread in place of these, that liberal democracy, in the end, is the best arrangement of politics by which people can be recognized on a kind of universal and rational basis.
Out of this was going to come an epic revolutionary attempt to reconstruct the world. The aim would be to create a utopia based on the idea of negative liberty. It would be a world in which all individuals would be free to do what they wanted without coercion by elites or tyrants any longer. It would be the triumph of Isaiah Berlin's idea of freedom, and it would begin in Russia. In 1992, the American government had passed the Freedom Support Act. Its aim was to help Russia reconstruct itself. Along with millions of dollars of aid came a group of young American advisors, economists and political theorists, who had a radical vision of what was necessary. They called it shock therapy. The aim was to remove all state control over the Russian economy at a stroke. All price subsidies would be removed, and all state industries privatized overnight. Their leader was a Harvard economist called Jeffrey Sachs.
We have the best hope right now, the best reformers, the most westward-looking leaders in this country, but there are people around that want to close up, that are the xenophobes, that are the extreme nationalists, that believe that the West has stabbed this country in the back. There are real possibilities of political disaster lurking here. It's not a matter of days, but it is a matter of weeks and months, and the people must have hope.
The Americans allied themselves with a group of young radical free marketeers around Yeltsin, and together they drew up a plan. Underlying it was a theory of how to transform society by creating new human beings. As last week's program showed, it was the same theory that lay behind the rise of what was called market democracy in Britain and America in the 1980s. The theory said that if one destroyed all the elite institutions that in the past had told people what to do, and instead allowed individuals to become independent in the marketplace, then they would become new kinds of rational beings, choosing what they wanted. Out of this would come a new form of order and a new kind of democracy, in which the market, not politics, gave people what they wanted. But things didn't work out as the theory predicted.
Что это такие проблемы? Советский Союз разрушен. Что это такие проблемы?
On the first day of the plan, all price controls in Russia were removed, and the cost of all goods soared. Millions of people found themselves unable to afford even the most basic of goods, and with no one to help them. The only solution for millions of Russians was to come out onto the streets and sell their belongings for anything they could get.
Где возьмем? Мы их продали, купили, позволили себе покушать. Правильно,
The chaos began to spread as the currency no longer had any value. Factories began to pay their workers in the products they made, which the people then had to sell wherever they could in order to live. then the privatization plan kicked in. Every Russian was given vouchers to buy shares in the privatized companies. But desperate for cash, they simply sold their vouchers to ruthless businessmen for a fraction of their worth. And a new elite began to emerge who snapped up vast sections of Russian industry. They became known as the oligarchs. Faced with this, the deputies in the Russian parliament began to protest against what they called economic genocide. It led to chaos and violence inside parliament. And in the face of this, the group of reformers around Yeltsin persuaded him he had to suspend parliament.
Сегодняшнего дня прерывается осуществление законодательной, распорядительной и контрольной функции съезда народных депутатов и Верховного Совета Российской Федерации.
In protest, the deputies occupied parliament. Yeltsin's response was brutal. He ordered the army to attack. The deputies were arrested, and Yeltsin announced that he would now rule by decree. Shock therapy continued, but in future, people were going to be made free through force and dictatorship. But what actually happened is that Yeltsin became the creature of those with the real power in the new Russia, the oligarchs. In return for loans, Yeltsin gave oligarchs like Boris Berezovsky the rest of Russian industry, sometimes at less than 2% of its real value. And then, in 1998, the experiment came dramatically to an end.
Russia's economy is out of control tonight and it's causing an international financial crisis. Huge queues in Moscow, there's a run on the banks, the ruble's lost nearly half its value and prices are soaring.
Пожалуйста, I found them frightened, baffled and angry. My money, she says, they won't give me my own money. What shall I do? I called Smolensky, the head of the bank, but his secretary said he wasn't in. It's horrible.
The days of economic reform seem to be well and truly over here.
Out of this economic catastrophe, a new order emerged. But it wasn't the spontaneous order dreamt of by the free market utopians. It was the very opposite. A harsh, tough nationalism imposed by the new president, Vladimir Putin. Putin arrested or exiled the major oligarchs and set about dismantling many of the democratic freedoms in the new Russia. But this was welcomed by the majority of Russians, who now wanted order, not freedom.
Yevgeny Kiselyov, Director General, NTV.
The people are interested in getting their wages paid in time. They want electricity back into their homes. Many of them are disillusioned in democratic values, don't care about freedom of speech, freedom of press, many other freedoms.
The idea of negative freedom that the market utopians had tried to create in Russia was based on a scientific idea of human beings as rational, calculating individuals who sought only their own desires and advantage. When Isaiah Berlin had defined that model back in the days of the Cold War, it had had a meaning and purpose as a safe alternative to the threat of communist tyranny. But now, in this new world, the grandeur that Berlin had given it fell away, and negative freedom was being revealed as the limited idea it really is. What President Putin could offer Russians were other things: security, dignity, and above all, a meaning that went beyond their own individual lives.
Vladimir Putin. We defended our great Soviet motherland and kept our independence. We're used to winning. It's in our blood. It's not just the way to win wars. In peacetime, it will also help us.
But at the start of the 21st century, there was going to be one more heroic attempt to spread the idea of negative liberty around the world. And one of the central figures in this utopian mission was going to be the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Right. Good morning, everyone. Now, in a moment, Michael's going to talk to you about...
When New Labour came to power, they had tried to apply the simplified economic model of human beings to all areas of society. And the Prime Minister's press conferences became an endless procession of graphs and tables, proving that the government was meeting its performance targets. This was the politics of negative liberty, trying to give people simply what they wanted. But Blair believed that politics could be more than this. He had read Isaiah Berlin's lecture on the two concepts of liberty. And after he came to power in 1997, Blair wrote a letter to Berlin. In the letter, Blair asks Berlin whether it is possible to go beyond the narrowness of negative liberty. The limitations of negative liberty, Blair wrote, are what have motivated generations of people to work for positive liberty, despite what happened in the Soviet Union. Surely, he asks Berlin, just because socialism has collapsed, it doesn't mean that the left can't have the confidence to fight against authority and tolerance and hierarchy and build a more equal society. Isaiah Berlin was on his deathbed and never replied. But what Blair was asking him was whether it was somehow possible to combine the two ideas of freedom. And this is what Blair was going to try and do, not at home, but abroad. It began in Kosovo. In 1998, Blair helped persuade the Americans to join a NATO bombing campaign of Serbia. The aim was to force President Milosevic to stop the ethnic cleansing by Serbian troops. For President Clinton, it was a short-term humanitarian mission. But Blair saw something far deeper. It was the beginning of a new, universal principle that should be applied across the world. In the modern interconnected global society, Blair believed that the West now had a duty to intervene in countries where individuals were threatened by tyranny and bring liberty to the people. He outlined this dramatic new vision at a speech in Chicago in 1999.
This is, I believe, a just war. Acts of genocide can never be a purely internal matter. If we can establish and spread the values of liberty, the rule of law, human rights and an open society, then that is in our national interest too. The spread of our values makes us indeed safer. Does anyone believe that Serbia or Iraq would be nations that originate conflict if they were democracies?
But it was the events of September the 11th that would transform Blair's principle into a revolutionary attempt to remake the world and bring freedom to millions of people.
The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us. I believe that this is a fight for freedom. From the deserts of northern Africa to the slums of Gaza to the mountain regions of Afghanistan, they too are our cause.
At the same time, the September the 11th attacks had brought many of the democratic revolutionaries from the 1980s back to influence in Washington. They and Blair now came together to try and spread democracy to the Middle East. And just as in the 80s, the same techniques of exaggeration and fear were employed to persuade the American people to back this. And Tony Blair found himself facing the same problem. Although he appealed to the British people to trust him in this radical vision, he now governed a society that distrusted politicians. As this series has shown, the simplified model of economic democracy was based on the theory that everyone, including politicians, were only driven by self-interest. And that idea had by now spread through the culture. Faced with this distrust, Blair employed what many saw as exaggeration and distortion. Perhaps he believed it was the only way to achieve his moral vision. The ends justified the means.